When I was a girl, I imagined Simon and his mates to be lovely Cornish fishermen. I thought of them as stocky men with hands like shovels and with twinkly blue eyes. They probably wore wellies and smocks. I loved the idea of being out on a boat at night, sailing under the stars, and of puttering back into a safe stone harbour at dawn. I imagined holds full of pilchards and scrawny cats who kept an eye on everything. Now that I'm older, I'm learning that Cornwall is not as idyllic as I thought. It has been, for the longest time, the poorest county in England. It was the last county to have a university. For centuries, any Cornish man or woman seeking tertiary education had to leave. Food produced in Cornwall is sent away to national distributors, and it comes back branded and expensive. And even fishing is not what I thought. It's an industry that is erratic and dangerous. There are good catches, and there are many bad catches. Seas are rough, boats are lost, and in early times, many people went hungry. In fact, the reason I stand here now is because of famine. In the 1840s, food was being produced in Cornwall, but it was being sent away to the ruling classes in England. And then the mining industry was collapsing. So there was no money and no food to buy anyway. It led to a mass migration. Some 20,000 Cornishmen left every week in the 1840s. And my ancestors were among them. The landscape is absolutely beautiful. But for many in Cornwall, life has been and continues to be pretty tough. In the same way, now that I'm older, I'm learning that my images of ancient Galilee were also romantic. And I'm learning about fishing. Because I've learned that fishing was deeply embedded into every aspect of Galilean life. Most of the Jesus stories came out of fishing villages, the harbour town at Capernaum, Bethsaida, which was also known as the temple of the fishing god, Gennesaret and Gerasim and others. One famous Mary came from Magdala, and the town of Magdala had a second name, Tarakaya, or processed fishville, that is, the place where they make salty fish. A high proportion of Jesus' first followers came from fishing villages, and they were involved in one way or another in the fishing industry. And this industry was hardly idyllic. It wasn't the multi-millionaire tuna fishermen from Port Lincoln. And nor was it just blokes in boats, catching a few fish and bringing them back to a local farmer's market in a free enterprise economy. And it certainly wasn't high status. Because they were involved in the production of food, Cicero included fishermen and fish sellers on his list of the most shameful occupations you could have. And because they were away from their homes and their families at night, their low status was entrenched in everybody else's eyes too. So fishermen were really low status. They were engaged in dirty and dangerous work in an industry where every aspect was controlled by the state. And the state wasn't exactly a socialist republic, using the taxes to fund schools and hospitals. The state, the Roman Empire and its client states, existed to control a very large peasant population and existed to funnel as much wealth as possible to the ruling elites. And to gather the wealth, the state focused on local industries, such as fishing. Around the Sea of Galilee, the state built harbours and sea walls and piers, and offices to administer fishing licences and to collect all the harbour taxes. And here is a state-constructed seawall in Cornwall. And the very important royal city of Tiberias, which is just near all the Jesus stories, was built to administer the fishing industry, and yet the Gospels barely mention it. When they do, it is to suggest that it's only outside of that city that people ever experienced abundance. So the state collected vast taxes, not through the paperwork and convenient electronic funds transfer that we know, but by any means, up to and including extreme physical violence visited on the female family members of people who owed the state money. You couldn't be a fisherman without encountering multiple layers of state control and taxes. You were part of a collective which contracted for fishing leases. You were taxed on using the harbour. You were taxed 40% of your catch. And even the distribution of the remaining catch was controlled by government-approved wholesalers. So by the time all the taxes were paid, only the very rich could afford to eat fish. And the physical dangers and the heavy burdens of the fishing leases led one Egyptian commentator of the time to describe fishing as the most miserable of all the professions. And it's into this context that tonight's story is set. It's to fishermen and their families that Jesus is preaching. It's fishermen who left their nets and followed him. When they left their nets, they left their means of meeting their legal obligations. They walked out of a legally constructed collective, which now had to fulfil its fishing leases without them. They left their means of earning an income. They left wives and children and other family members. They left everything, absolutely everything, to follow Jesus. What sort of desperate hope would lead a man to do that? I find it hard to imagine myself back in the first century Mediterranean world. So I go back to what I know, the stories of Cornishmen coming to Australia. In the 1840s, in some areas of Cornwall, between infant mortality, cholera, mining accidents, lung disease, and the ravages of malnutrition, the life expectancy was just 19. 19. By contrast, thanks to the fresh air, the food, the dryness, and the different mining techniques used in Burra in South Australia, the life expectancy was 45. Brave the journey, and you more than doubled your life expectancy and that of your children. And that's why Australia is full of Sampsons and Bennetts and Pembethys and Curnows and Goldsworthys and Perrins and all the other old Cornish names. Of course, these stout Methodists were not following the human person of Jesus in the first century, but they give us a glimpse of what might drive a man to leave his family and his work and to head into a wildly uncertain future. And so I come back to hope. Hope that there's more to life than working to the point of collapse. Hope that work could lead to some form of richness, not just constant hunger or emptiness. Hope that you could live free from the violence and the exploitation of empire. Hope that life could be bigger, more abundant, more extravagant, even if for just a little while. These days, the story of indentured fishermen dropping everything to follow Jesus speaks to women in sweatshops and men in diamond mines and children in tomato fields. It speaks to young men in Afghanistan and families in Syria and the poor of America. It speaks to single parents in Australia, people who work their guts out and yet still struggle to pay rent and feed their kids properly, and who get very little respect. Here is a man who offers freedom, and nets so teeming with life that they begin to break. But this story is also for those of us who are higher up the economic scale. It's to open our eyes to the grief of the world, yes, but it is also to show us a way out of empire. Many of us betray deep fear and full capitulation to the system, and I count myself among this. We see in the hours many of us work, with very little time made for family or friends or lazing about in the presence of God. We see in it how, see it in how few of us give generously, let alone sacrificially, out of our great abundance. We see it in the money we pour into insurances and investments and superannuation, with little concern for how the money is used or how it could be used in a different economy. We see it in the way we all consume without regard for effect, whether food or clothes or electronics or petrol or everything else. We're terrified of poverty. We're terrified of simplicity. And we're terrified of those on the underside of history. But even to us, Jesus offers hope and a path to freedom. A path which might lead us to question the hours we work and to wonder about our priorities. A path which might challenge us to rethink the ways we're financially enmeshed with our bank accounts and our home loans and our investment portfolios and our superannuation. A path which is shared with strangers from all different backgrounds, strangers who might initially seem threatening, but who one day will become friends. A path marked by hospitality and generosity, where the abundance is no longer parcelled off into small households, but is shared, and everybody has more than enough. Such a path seems terrifying when we try to control our own lives, when we place all our trust in work and money and investments for the future. Such a path seems too holy for a sinful people who cannot see our way out of empire. Go away from me, we cry, as we fall to our knees. But Jesus puts out his hand with tenderness and raises you to your feet. Don't be afraid, he says. This is who you are. And he points you in a new direction, full of strangers and dangers and turmoil and wonder. And in that vision of a new way, a new future which is leaping with silvery hope, you will find the courage to leave everything. Amen.